From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul the P.O. Deccant. But most importantly, you are you and you are here. And that makes this stuff they don't want you to know.
Like parole officer?
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we're big fans of acronyms. Just
mail
us, your,
Mail us your favorite.
Yeah. Mail us your favorite.
He's peed off.
Oh, boy. Right now, usually Paul will have a talkback mic turned on so he can tell us how lame he thinks our jokes are.
But we took it away because he was hurting our feelings.
So he's throwing us thumbs up and thumbs down.
That's not a thumb, my friend.
Let's hope we do him proud.
That was just shade. All right.
We have, you know, you can tell we all get along famously, folks, and we have a lot of levity on this show. Part of the reason that we're opening with some jokes today is because today we are going to examine something that is incredibly important, not just in the U.S., but in the world overall. And it's also something that isn't fully explored in your typical mainstream news stories. You'll maybe hear 5 minutes about something, right, on CNN or on MSNBC or Fox News or whatever your news program of choice is.
This is a topic today that you probably won't know a lot about unless it's touched your life in some way, very close, within a few degrees.
Absolutely. I mean, and now we are seeing some very alarmist, I would say reasonably so, headlines that is pushing some of this stuff to the forefront, which we'll get into as well. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's certainly not something that was across my day-to-day thinking.
Mm-hmm. Friends and neighbors, if you are a resident of the United States, you've probably heard about the burgeoning and long-standing problems with this country's justice and incarceration system. And our episode today focuses on another aspect of that system that the authorities, the politicians, and yes, the private prison companies would probably rather you not know much about. That is its effect on children. And as you know, if you are a longtime listener, one of Matt, Noel, and I's favorite things to do when we are tackling a topic of this magnitude is to find an expert. And luckily, this time we succeeded. We would like to introduce to you Julian Wyatt. Julian, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Julian, tell us about the organization you're a part of and what you do within that organization.
Yeah, so Forever Family is an Atlanta-based nonprofit that was founded in 1987 by Sandra Barnhill. She's still the current executive director and CEO. The work we do is pretty much aimed at maintaining and preserving the family bond for children or families who are experiencing incarceration. So one of our taglines is surrounding children with the love of family, but that's also like our approach as well. So one of the most popular and longest running programs is that of the Family Visitation Program, where we once a month gather up all the children involved in the organization, and we provide transportation as well as meals to the children as well as caregivers. And we make about a 3-hour drive there and back to three of the four women prisons within here in Georgia. So that's Emmanuel, Lee Arendelle, as well as Pulaski. Other than that, you know, we just want to make sure that, you know, children are still aware that, you know, they're not alone with this experience. Mm-hmm. Assuming those for the parents who are incarcerated. We provide different workshops throughout the year so they can, you know, feel confident about their abilities to still be involved in their child's life while they're, you know, still serving their prison sentence. And for the caregivers as well, which is also left out of the popular narrative, we provide different support and services for them to ease the financial burden as they take care of, you know, some of the children involved.
And for a real quick statistical background here, we know that the U.S. represents about 4.4% of the world's total population, but houses around 22% of the world's prisoners. And it was shocking to us. It was shocking to us that children were not included or were missed in the narrative, as you say. We'd like to ask a couple of questions about the kids themselves. Do they have a typical age range, or does it go across a spectrum?
It's usually across the spectrum. So even for our organization, we work from infants all the way up through to the age of 18.
Wow. So these are – you said you're primarily servicing women's prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are moms that you're going to visit.
Yes.
And you're taking the children to go visit their moms in prison.
Correct.
Have you actually physically gone along with some of these visitations?
I have. My first prison visitation back in 2014 when I was first interning at Forever Family. And it's a powerful and moving experience. We get to the organization about 5 o'clock in the morning. We provide, you know, meals to the children. You know, we try to just make it as upbeat and friendly as possible, though, because I know for some they are excited. And also for some, it's kind of a difficult, you know, difficult situation. But we, you know, we make sure that they have, you know, food on the bus right there. So when we get in there, we have to check in, which is like an hour-long process. It's no joke from background checks we all have to get. Once we get there, if you're a child, I think under the age of 13, you're still able to go into the children's center. And this is not at all three prisons. I think this is just maybe at Pulaski, one more. Not for certain, I have to cross-reference that. And if you're over the age of 13 to 18, then you go to the general population. So I've had the opportunity to go into the children's center, actually for Mother's Day weekend, which was amazing. So we provided food, the mothers cooked, they had routines, and it's just so much physical connection and love. And since they know that I have direct contact with their children on a regular basis, they ask me questions about, you know, how's Johnny doing in school? If he's, you know, messing up here, feel free to give him a talk and pull him to the side. So it's a great experience. You could tell that it benefits both the mother who's incarcerated as well as the child. So statistically wise, if you maintain this relationship, then those who are in prison are more likely to be conscious of their behavior while they're serving their time, mm-hmm. and also it decreases the likeliness of recidivism that they'll return and reoffend. And for the child at the same time, you know, that still having that connection ensures that they're not missing out on much, and they're, you know, still surrounded by that love and are able to then succeed and move forward and develop as a normal child would.
And let's go back to something that you just mentioned that may amaze and surprise a lot of us in the audience here, and that is the process that not just the children, but you and everyone who attempts a visitation has to undergo in order to actually make it in to visit the people imprisoned. You said it's an hour-long process.
It is, and we try to get there as early as possible so we get to the front of the line and make sure that the children have as much time as possible to spend with their mothers. But it's – you have to go through the metal detectors and, mm-hmm. you know, they – it's kind of dehumanizing in a sense. Mm-hmm. To the fact that once you get into this institution, then you kind of lose a sense of, you know, yourself and freedom at the same time that you're giving up. So myself, as, you know, being a chaperone or a staff member, as well as the children as well, who are kind of serving, are incarcerated but outside of the institution at the same time. So
mm-hmm. any kind of bureaucratic system like that, it always feels like you're in some kind of cattle call or you're stuck in some way. It's very claustrophobic, mm-hmm. I think, is a word that I would use to describe
mm-hmm.
it. I can't imagine for a child having to go through that.
And that's a great point about bureaucracies. Noel, as you just said, these are arduous organizations, some would say inherently. And when we are talking about bureaucracies for institutions that are seen as quote-unquote justly punishing someone for taking a taboo or illegal action, then oftentimes the reforms of those bureaucracies fall to the bottom of the list when it comes to funding, when it comes to positive action of any sort. And one of the questions that was on our mind that we wanted to ask you is whether you or your colleagues or the caregivers, the parents, or even the children have encountered this bureaucracy acting in a, well, I don't want to say an antagonistic manner, but maybe an unhelpful manner.
Yeah, that's very true. So I think we do criminals. They're labeled as master status of always being criminals and need to be punished accordingly. We know, you know, sometimes sentencing is not as rational or, you know, as in line in regards to the offense. But I think diminished expectations by society also believes that these kids of the incarcerated will end up with their parents. And so they treat them accordingly, and they don't believe they're going to amount to much and be successful. So it comes down to then the work that we do is I guess the term that we use in sociology, but like the labeling theory. So if you call these children, you know, criminals, you say they're going to amount to only to what their parents have done and so forth, they're going to start to internalize that. And then it just repeats the cycle then of them, you know, getting wrapped up in another system. And you know, some of these times they will, the likelihood of them going or being incarcerated increases and so forth. So we do our best to try to combat some of that as much as possible.
The idea of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right,
kind of,
exactly. You know.
And we'll return to the untold story of incarceration and the children it affects with Julian Wyatt after a brief word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And off air, we were somewhat joking about private prisons.
Which is some real gallows humor,
Matt. It really is. But we brought up a company that was formerly, I guess, known as CCA, the Something Corrections of America.
It was the Corrections Corporation of America, yeah. I believe, yeah.
So, Julian, you told us that they recently changed their name.
Yes, I was doing some research on them recently, and they rebranded themselves as Core Civic, I'm sure.
Core Civic?
Core Civic, yeah.
Okay.
I guess it's Oof. A little less harsh.
It's but, the core of civics.
Right.
They should have taken it all the way and become like the Happy Fun Time Company.
Jeez.
That's what they're a region for, it seems. Yeah, but they rebranded, I'm sure, for different the reputations and so what they've been getting over the years.
It's such an innocuous non-name. It's like, what does that mean?
Sure.
What does that tell us anything about what you do?
Right.
Private housing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what they call
sure,
themselves.
Sure, yeah, housing.
So
yeah.
could you tell us and our audience a little bit more about what we mean when we say private prisons?
Basically, just as the term kind of explains there, it's some of these prisons are run by private organizations, and then they have such a big state at, you know, maintaining the status quo of mass incarceration or, you know, the prison industrial complex because it benefits them. I was looking at some of the CCA information, and they actually negotiate their contracts so that they are saying that you have to make sure that the incarceration rate or the capacity is at 90%.
The number of people in
the
beds.
Number of people, yes.
They have a minimum guarantee for bodies and bunks.
Correct.
Wow.
Minimum quotas for sentencing. Then the whole mandatory minimum sentencing comes into play as well. So it gets deep, and they have a pretty large stake percentage of the amount of prisons that they run in the U.S.
So it's what some might refer to as the prison industrial complex.
Right.
Because there's money going into the
exactly.
system. There are people that have things to gain from this monetarily. Mm-hmm. I just was going to briefly bring up, I once did a story for public radio about a town where they had lost their entire industry. It was like in the housing boom. I can't remember the name of the town now, but it was in Georgia, rural part of Georgia, and they had lost their whole manufacturing. It was tied to like textiles or something. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted this prison. They wanted it so bad because it was going to give jobs. And I went to like an event that the CCA people did, and it was just like telling them how great it was going to be. Yeah. Everyone was going to have jobs, and they didn't end up getting it. Yeah. But it was like it was just weird to me that we were like, please, please give us this prison.
It's surreal, isn't it? And this goes to a systemic issue you may have seen in the news a number of years ago about certain judges who got caught sentencing kids wildly out of proportion off to juvie, to juvenile detention centers, because they were guaranteed a certain payment per head. Luckily, for now in the U.S., that is technically illegal. However, it sounds like what we're exploring when we bring up the prison industrial complex, incarceration in general, is we're bringing up the idea of tying profit to prison in a way that, again, is technically not illegal. I don't want to say it's legal. It's not illegal. It's kind of tricky. It's like, don't be evil. That's not the same thing as be good. Mm-hmm. And one thing you said just now that really stuck with me, and we should examine this a little further in depth. Julian, you just said that these private entities are influencing mandatory sentencing. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's definitely a relationship between corporations and politicians. This has come up in the last, like, decade. There's been – try to keep, you know, hush-hush, but there's individuals who are lobbying to maintain the status quo with these minimum sentences and so forth. Yeah, definitely.
Man, I have a question. In Atlanta in particular, we recently had a change in the mandate of police officers to not take people to jail for marijuana, for certain amounts of marijuana. It's not so far as to say marijuana is now legal in Atlanta, but for all intents and purposes, cops aren't supposed to take you to jail if you have a joint or a certain amount of weed on you.
At their discretion.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other thing. But my understanding of it was an effort to prevent some of this overcrowding and some of these low-level offenders that end up in the system and get completely screwed over for the rest of their lives. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that goes back to, oh my gosh, the war on drugs and
crack and all that.
Exactly, yeah. From the 70s and moving forward. But I think they're on both sides of the aisle now. We're seeing a need to – this is a problem. Mass incarceration is a problem. It's costing a lot of money in regards to the federal budget and everything else. So now I think mandatory prison sentences
Let's define the term real quick, just to catch up with the idea of mandatory minimums.
So it basically means that no matter what, if you get caught with, say, for drugs, the majority of individuals who are incarcerated, legislation that's passed and policies say that you have to receive a certain amount of prison or jail time for this offense.
Yeah, and it's usually not small.
Not small, and it's actually increased over the decades.
Yeah, and it's the minimum.
Mm-hmm. There's a meta level to it as well, because mandatory sentencing might not just kick in for a possession of X amount of drug Y. It also can kick in if this is your second or third crime of
yes,
nature.
Yes, three
right?
strikes. That was a three strikes. And that was, under Clinton, that was the issue as well.
I really appreciate you pointing out that that was under President Clinton.
That was.
And that's going to come up a little later, actually.
Yes.
It just goes to show money isn't partisan. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we demonize certain parties and raise up others. But when you look at the numbers, there's stuff happening on both sides that are feeding the beast, you know?
Definitely.
Money votes for itself.
Exactly.
And it votes every day.
Yeah.
So what – if it's okay, we'd like to ask you a couple of biographical questions.
Sure.
What drew you to this project, this mission, and where would you like to see it go?
Great question. So I'm fortunate enough that neither my mother nor father were incarcerated through my childhood. But I can't say that narrative holds true for some of my close relatives as well as my childhood friends that I've grown up with, originally from Los Angeles, California. I wouldn't say the Santa Monica's and the Hollywoods, one of my, like, Long Beaches and Inglewood and, you know, Compton. So some of these, like, urban areas who are now decaying and so forth. It's something that I've been affected by. I know there have been at times when I've seen friends get arrested, and it's been as simple as something that hasn't been as traumatic. Other times I've seen doors being kicked down and everything else in between. When I was a child, I opened up the door and there goes the FBI saying they're looking for, you know, a wanted criminal. So, and as a child, that's somewhat traumatizing, you know what I mean? And even though we're speaking of, like, the family as a unit, there have been times when, like, my mother has had to, you know, house some of my friends or some of my cousins because my aunts and uncles have been involved in the criminal justice system or now are incarcerated, and to avoid them getting wrapped into the criminal ward of the state and getting into foster care and everything else like that. Mm-hmm. My mother, you know, stepped up to the plate and wanted to do her part in ensuring that, you know, the children were still comfortable and moving forward. And she felt like that was her role. So on top of, you know, trying to use all her resources to help my relatives out with court fees and, you know, trials and so forth, attorney fees, she's also now having to take care of another body, another human, and, you know, children like to eat, right? So it's things like that it just hits home. And then moving out here, I got involved with the organization when I was an intern in undergrad, and just the families and children that I've, you know, came in contact with, it just resonated with me. I look at them like, on my own, my family members at this point. So, and then progressively, I just became more involved in the organization. I'm a member of the Young Professionals Board, and I'll be the president of the Young Professionals Board for the organization in July.
So, wow, man. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
And honestly, it's a huge just tribute to the dedication and the love that your family shares to take on those. I mean, in a way, it's a burden. It's also a privilege in other ways to take care of a child in that way. But yeah. That's huge because not every family has that kind of bond and that determination. And can you just tell us a little bit about what happens to, let's say, a kid whose mom ends up wrapped up in the criminal justice system, goes to prison, and there's nobody else to take care of this kid?
Mother and father, potentially.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe start with the day they learn that they're going.
Yeah. Like what happens to this kid?
Not enough emphasis goes on to taking the child into consideration at all when it comes to the sentencing. But from my experience of what I've seen is luckily it's usually a grandparent who takes the responsibility of looking after the child. So I know the majority of the children who are in program, that's the case, which has its own issues to a certain level. But, yeah, once you get wrapped up into the system, someone just get lost, and then you can't advocate for yourself, and you know, then it's a disconnect between, you know, the state wanting to keep you away from your child, and you not knowing or having legal knowledge to even know what steps you need to take to, you know, ensure your relationship is maintained with that child. So it's challenging.
Wow.
So is there any state level or federal level substantive assistance in solving this problem?
Oh, there possibly could be, but the one that I'm aware of at the top of my head, I couldn't speak on.
Mm.
Okay, so there's a grandparent. That's obviously a best-case scenario. Mm. But a lot of times there's not. And then you have kids that get in the foster care system, for example. And I know that can end up great for children. That can ultimately be a positive situation where they find their foster parents, ultimately adopt them, etc. But that is a form of a child being in a system that they have no control over and that at times they have no ability to escape.
Right.
So can you give us kind of the less rosy version of that scenario? Maybe, I don't know, just whatever you see on the ground.
From what I see on the ground, preserving that immediate family or that the extended family tends to have better outcomes for both the child as well as the parent who's incarcerated. It's a level of trust and stability. We're just having to get, you know, outside, you know, entities or actors involved in making decisions. And it just gets a little bit more complex on top of already having a parent incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely hear horror stories. Mm-hmm. About the, you know, situations that can occur within foster care and the foster care system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not all horror stories,
no.
But that's definitely the ones that rise at the top because they're newsworthy.
If it bleeds, it leads, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I know that a lot of foster parents do it because it's like a per kid amount of money that you get, and that's, you know, maybe a negative way you can look at it. But also, my ex-wife's sister has fostered children for years and ended up adopting like five of them, three of which were siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
And they just have the most lovely, loving, middle-class, affluent family. Then they take care of those kids like they're their own because they are.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like the best case scenario. Ooh. But then you have ones where you hear about neglect and malnourishment. And you hear about kids dying in the foster care system from beatings and abuse. And you don't have to look far to find examples of this happening in the news to the point where we're almost numb to it in a certain way.
Very true.
And this brings us to a natural segue, something that many, many of us listening along were already thinking of as soon as we tuned into this episode. It hits upon something that has made the news in a very real and immediate, and as we record, an ongoing way. We are going to delve into the story behind the stories you've read about children being separated from their parents at the border of the U.S. after a word from our sponsor. And we're back from about, what was it, Matt? May 2018?
Yeah, it was like early May 2018 up until June 20th. Actually, the day we're recording this episode.
From about that that time span, you probably saw in your media of choice, whether that's a social platform or a mass market news program, you probably saw the reports of numerous children traveling with their family or in some cases solo from a foreign country to the U.S. and then not only being detained at the border but being separated from their parents. And when we say kids, we're not talking teenagers. We're talking children.
And when we say numerous, we're not talking about a handful. We're talking about more than 2,000.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. 2,343 according to the NPR as of early May.
Julian, you've been following this story. Would you say that there is a connection or a confluence between the immigration detainment industry and the prison industry?
So, yeah, I think there's definitely some parallels between our criminal justice system as well as our detention system. I think we were speaking on still the mandatory sentencing. It's still the same that goes in with these immigration detention centers. There's quotas as well. The private prison industry is also heavily involved in the detention system. But I think even still just having the spotlight on the children, these are still traumatic events that they're just probably going to stick with them for each in their life if they're not receiving the proper, you know, services to try to combat some of these experiences, definitely.
You know, it's crazy. I've seen Jeff Sessions, the current Attorney General of the United States.
Jeff Beauregard Sessions.
Yes.
I just like saying Beauregard.
Well, he's described this practice of separating the children from the other family members as a deterrence, as a strategic deterrence to prevent other people and other families with children from trying to cross the border into the United States. And it's based on a law that was passed during the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. and the way it's written is it's not vague. It's just current – that administration as well as other administrations had not really pushed it that far, mm-hmm. essentially, like taken it to this level of separating these families forcibly. Yeah. But it's something that's been on the books for a while. So a lot of us have probably seen the videos of – the situation that these kids find themselves in physically, which is in essentially these large cages where there are multiple children. They're not stacked up, but they're just squished into these cages. And what they've got is some like water, it looked like, and maybe a little bit of food like chips or something, and these thermal blankets mm-hmm. that they're putting on each other. Mm-hmm. And how does that sounds insane to me. Is that experience mirrored anywhere within the juvenile system at all, or is that a completely new thing?
I would say the portrayal of this situation to a certain extent was intentional.
Okay.
Like you said, going back to serving as a mechanism for deterrence for those who are – most of them are migrating from, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Mm-hmm. So if they're seeing this on the media, that they're going to, probably hold off or think twice about coming our way. Even in the past with African-American males being, portrayed as, these deviant criminals and so forth back in, the 70s or civil rights era moving forward, it's kind of the same thing to serve as a deterrence or to, shift behavior to get a certain outcome that you want, which still goes back to then the whole element of politics that's brought into this.
Yeah, that's the thing that bugged me the most. It seems very clear. There's a lot of passing the buck going on where it's like, sure, we're doing this, but it's actually the folks on the other side's fault, but we're just enforcing the law, blah, blah, blah. But then you could look at it and say, well, it's really just kind of a deterrent. It's like you're punishing people for doing something that technically is legal, because a lot of these folks are seeking asylum.
Right.
And then all of a sudden their kids are snatched away because of this zero tolerance policy. Mm-hmm. So that to me seems like dirty pool.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. It is legal to seek asylum.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, under UN conventions, it's legal to seek asylum and entry with any country.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately up to that country's discretion. And they're very loose with the idea of discretion.
Yeah, well, apparently we're leaving the UN Human Rights Council anyway. So
that's true. That happened yesterday.
We just did. Wow. Yeah. Great.
So let's keep this thread though with the immigration policy. You'll notice Matt pointed out from May to June 20th. Peek behind the scenes here, folks. Julie and Matt, Noel and I are recording this on June 20th, and as we were going into the studio here, we learned that the current president, President Trump, had actually signed a document, right, that is going to end not the detainment practice, but end the separation practice. Isn't that correct, Noel?
That is what I read, yes. It's a breaking news story as we sit here and record this now, but pressure has apparently gotten to the administration in that respect. Because it's what they call bad optics, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're not technically breaking the law or you're enforcing the law, it's not a good look. Mm-hmm. You know?
Not at all.
I believe what the president signed is an executive order, correct? That would be – which just means that he doesn't have to run it past Congress.
He's a fan of those.
I've got something up on time. We're literally looking at this on our computers right now. It's just talking about, yeah, he signed an executive order that would end the separations, but instead putting the parents and children together in – these detention centers, like the Stewart. Have you ever been to Stewart Detention Center?
It's the one here in Georgia, right?
Yeah.
I have some friends who've gone and visited there, did some work, but I personally haven't.
Yeah, it's massive. My sister has done work with some organizations there too, and it's just these huge centers where they're in that location. There are families together, some of them. Sometimes they're separated. And it's just, man, it is a tough situation for anyone to find themselves in, and especially for a child.
Yeah.
And I can't get over this, you guys. Like, Noel and I have kids. Wyatt, do you have kids yet?
No kids yet.
You and Ben, one day, don't worry, you guys are going to have powerful, amazing kids.
None that I know of, yeah.
Oh, dear. But it, just the thought, Noel, of someone taking your child away and putting him in a cold, dark, just like place like that without any chance to either go to your, you know, your parents or your grandparents or some other family member, or just being sent back even, you know, just like just leave and go somewhere else. It makes your blood boil. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happened to a lot of people in this country and around the world as we're reading this stuff.
Well, and given like how difficult it is to even get a phone call if you go to jail, right?
Yeah.
I'm only conjecturing here, but I imagine that there's not ready lines of communication between mom and dad and son and daughter, you know?
Yeah.
And there's one other important point here that we have to emphasize of the many important points, which is that for people who feel that a detainment policy is just, for people who feel like, well, you know, it's against the law, don't try to cross the border. And even if you plead asylum, it is up to that country's discretion for how long they detain you and whether or not they grant you entry or they kick you back with a go with God. Regardless of how you feel about that, the children involved do not have agency. And in institutions and communities across the country, these kids are not making the choices. They are only suffering the consequences.
Yeah.
And this brings us to a question about the future, which I know sometimes people hate because no one can predict it. But Julian, having lived in this world and spent so much time working toward a better future for these parents, these children, and ultimately, I would argue, our country as a whole, what recommendations could you make? What would you like to see change?
Great question. Definitely, I think some of the most common, and we're getting some traction here, is some of the reversing of some of the policies that were enacted over the last few decades with things such as three strikes or mandatory minimum. But also, I think we need to put a bigger emphasis on more of a community supervision. So, and I think a lot of people think that if we, you know, in mass incarceration and there's less inmates, then it may necessarily be cheaper on taxpayers. Down the road, I think that may be the case, but immediately, I think the resources just need to be shifted and allocated towards, you know, social services and community-based organizations to provide, you know, psychosocial support, education, vocational training, support for housing, which would give these individuals some type of support system that they can, you know, build on. And then on another end, I think that I recommend that, you know, different policies or mechanisms be put in place that those who are doing the sentencing or prosecuting do a holistic or a deeper in-depth assessment on the children who are going to be impacted as well. Look at things such as what are they going to be their need? Do they have caregivers who can, you know, swoop in and take care of them during sentencing and so forth, which I don't think is done as adequately or as efficiently as needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think also on the back end of this, which doesn't get talked about, is also that of the caregivers. So it's we talked about like a financial burden. Many of these caregivers are, you know, senior citizens, 50, 60 years old, low income. So they're more than likely retired and receiving some type of government assistance. And now they're having to take care of someone else. I would like to see, you know, more support given to them, maybe subsidizing, you know, some type of, you know, monetary payment for the time being. But there's just, I mean, there's a lot of different alternatives that can be, you know, put in place or implemented to kind of, you know, shift some of this climate that we have right now.
It does become a form of foster care in a way mm-hmm. when you're like a grandmother taking care of your granddaughter or grandson.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'd like to see that. So let's say someone's listening to this and they want to help out. Is there a place online they can go to learn more or a number they can call or what can they do to help with this struggle?
Definitely for a resource you can go to is our website, foreverfam.org. That's forever fam. It's forever, F-O-R-E-V-E-R, fam, F-A-M.org. And you could, you know, there's information you could reach out to if you know someone who may be need assistance with, you know, navigating through our correctional or criminal justice system, children who might be impacted, educators, if just anything for any other speaking engagements or any recommendations, mm-hmm. please feel free to reach out to us. But there's plenty of resources here. You go to, we got the Dome here. Go to some of our state departments and so forth. And yeah,
is it possible to volunteer and just like show up and help out?
Definitely. We have events going on pretty much year round. Things as simple as like back to school programs or events where we're giving out backpacks and, you know, just stuff like that. Little dinners we host. We have a 5K walk that's coming up in August. That's actually going to be right across the street.
Nice.
So, yeah, there's always ways.
Now we have to go.
Yeah, heck yeah.
Knocking on windows now.
Please.
And I just wanted to mention real quick, I couldn't help but notice a Facebook fundraising effort that popped up on my feed yesterday called Reunite an Immigrant Parent with Their Child. And I couldn't help but notice that it had raised almost $13 million. Jeez. It's from an organization called RACES, which stands for the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, which is a nonprofit based out of San Antonio, Texas. So that is a very interesting ongoing cause that would be worth checking into as well.
And just to show you how quickly all of this is moving, when Paul showed me that Facebook post this morning, they had raised $9 million.
That's insane. I think when I donated to it, they had raised like 8 or something. Mm-hmm. And their goal is $15 million.
Wow.
Which is insane. It just goes to show. And then, you know, with the reversal mm-hmm. of the administration, mm-hmm. obviously the optics of these things really does matter. So this notion of, well, nothing I can do about it, that's not always true.
That's false.
So how do we raise money for all of these kids whose parents are in prison mm-hmm. domestically?
Well, the thing is that you can make an argument that one of us alone may not swing the needle too much mm-hmm. one way or the other. But it's like that old proverb, if you want to travel fast, travel alone. If you want to travel far, travel with people, mm-hmm. right? And so the fact of the matter is sometimes this gets cast off as being cliche or whatever, but together we can make some sort of positive difference that is not politically aligned. You know, I think it's safe to say in 2018 – it's not controversial to help children.
Yeah. I believe you're right.
Call it a hot take if we must. But
And obviously this immigration thing is a politically divisive issue, and we're not here to preach politics to anybody. Sure. It's more just about human rights, general goodness, and the idea that kids deserve a fair shake no matter where they come from or what their background is.
Absolutely. The press is a powerful tool, and one thing that's important that I think a lot of mass media producers don't want us to know is that you are part of the press. It is a two-way street. The people who speak to you can also hear you. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to – I know it's a hassle. Nobody writes letters anymore, but that's why they matter more now.
That's a really good point, Ben.
Yeah, it really is a good point. Yeah. I'm going back to the thing that we've discussed a couple of times on this show, and it is my personal belief that the current administration is in some way like a sleeper agent, where they're going in and doing the worst possible things, taking things to an nth degree so that we can all see it first, like for the – like truly see it, and then all go, no!
This is your weirdest as conspiracy a society. Theory. That is a really odd if optimistic view.
I mean
– and I hope that that's the case.
We hope so. Julian, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. We want to leave the last word to you. Is if you could say anything about the consequences for children who are innocent bystanders in the justice system, if you could say anything about it to whomever is listening to this now or in the future, what would that be?
They have to be – children now have to be part of the dominant narrative when it comes to, you know, our criminal justice system. Right now I feel like they're left out of so much, but are affected tremendously by some of these decisions. So just moving forward, just wanted to bring a sense of awareness and just kind of raise the consciousness of individuals to know that this is actually, you know, going on and moving forward, just to be aware of that.
Okay. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're Conspiracy Stuff, and Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. You can reach us via telephone, 1-833-STDWYTK. Oh, yeah. It's fun to say. It's even more fun to dial, so go ahead and do that. But you need to use numbers probably. Okay, so you can do all of those things. You can find stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com. That's our website. You can find every podcast we've ever put out there. Or, hey, we're on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a review, which would be cool, super cool.
You can find every video that we have ever done, several of which touch on CCA, the private prison industry, as
absolutely.
A whole.
Absolutely. I shudder to think. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can always send us a good old-fashioned email. Our best ideas come from you. Our email is
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.